Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
This week we're going to continue with our account of English towns in the 16th century. Now that's not only of inherent interest, and I hope it's interesting to people, well otherwise I assume you wouldn't be listening, but also it is a deliberate antiphony to the cacophony of sounds surrounding politics at the present moment. So if you want to have continuous hubble bubble of faddism on the present day and this sort of, you know, chasing around like a prostitute about around the income to be derived from opining upon the present moment, then please go and listen to Radio 4, or please go and listen to whatever faddishness appears on other history podcasts. Here we actually stick to our purpose, that at the end of the day you will be better informed and be able to make your own choices of what you think is of consequence in terms of change or continuity. So we're going on with the Tudor town, and I hope you enjoy it. And certainly, I hope if you're feeling bothered by politics in Britain or France or America or anywhere, I hope you can see this as a pleasant antidote. Now, those of you who are fortunate enough to live in England and to travel in it will know that surviving buildings from the period testify to urban activity and wealth. In my own town, Exeter, the Tudor house, the house that moved, I mean, it was moved in order to avoid destruction when the vandals of the 1960s thrust through an urban road. Hilariously enough, I was being told by some prime boar on Saturday morning that, you know, planners and business always together produce what is better for the urban environment. Well, I can tell you that's not the case in Exeter. Anyway, the Tudor house in Exeter is one example, but for example, the timber-framed Guildhall of Corpus Christi in Lavenham is another, or Paycock's, a merchant house in Coggers Hall, or the Elizabethan house on the New Street in Plymouth, Greyfriars in Worcester, the Elizabethan house museum in Great Yarmouth. All of these are particularly attractive examples. Now, they'll be, in some respects, uncharacteristic or atypical, I should say, because many people would have lived in dwellings which we might characterise more readily as hovels. I think that might not be a fair description, because they'd be living within their means in accordance with what was possible. But nevertheless, one ought to be aware that many people do not live in these terms. But nevertheless, these surviving Tudor buildings show what was possible. And the world of things very much focused on towns and indicated what could be your living standards. And it was one which, of course, encompassed books. And as we will know, books were linked, and the interest in what could be conveyed with books were linked to the Reformation in the sense of a sort of account of the Reformation which doesn't simply present it in terms of Henry VIII's marital diplomacy, if that's not a polite word. Instead of which, one might see Protestantism as emerging very much from the milieu of people who read the Bible, had their own thoughts about theology and doctrine, were not interested in taking papal injunctions, and that these were very significant to the Protestant Reformation in Britain. And of course, the Reformation very much changed the face of cities with the suppression of monastic foundations, and each foundation that was dissolved was an opportunity to rethink as well as sell the space. But also there was a need to address the provision which the church had provided in terms of social and educational and medical care. These now all needed to be rethought, and the urgency of rethinking them was most pronounced in the urban environment. Now, I ought to say that the background was one of energetic lay piety. In many towns, this can be seen in a number of respects. The role of lay fraternities in places like Norwich, of lay philanthropy via the church, but also there was considerable church building and renovation in the late 15th and early 16th century. There's very interesting examples of that in Suffolk, in Bristol, in the southwest, the major enlargement of St. Michael's Honiton from 1478, a rather triumphant church near where I live. But not only there, Carlisle Cathedral gained splendid choir stalls in the mid-15th century. And Rochester Cathedral, which was another monastic cathedral, was embellished by a perpendicular-style lady chapel in 1490. The perpendicular, a style we associate most with, shall we say, Salisbury Cathedral, was very much still a living style in the late 15th and early 16th century, and great buildings were still being built in it. Within towns, churches served as the centres of identity, linking the generations. Their parish churches were the venues for weddings, baptisms and burials, and their funerary monuments were a place of admonition and record, as well as memory and loss. And this memory represented by a sense of family coherence focused on churches. Now, the Reformation transformed the situation, not least by transferring ownership of monasteries, nunneries, and much church wealth and patronage, and by encouraging, or at least allowing, the destruction of buildings. For example, if you go to Glastonbury, by which I mean the town, not the pop festival, the 15th century tower is all that remains of St. Michael's Church on Glastonbury Tor. That was part of Glastonbury Abbey, one of the many monasteries ruined at the dissolution. Other urban monasteries that were turned into ruins, which you can still see the ruins today, included that of Bury St. Edmunds, or some of the 12,000 tons of stone used by the Cecils to cover the large facade of Burley House came from monastic buildings in Stamford, and so on and so forth. Those who were close to the establishment gained much wealth accordingly. Thomas Cromwell, for example, gained Lewes Priory. There was also much change in individual churches. So the church warden's accounts of Bishop Stortford have been published, and they show that, as required by law and therefore under pressure from the central government, an English language Bible was purchased in 1541 and 42. So that's in Henry VIII's reign, while in 1547-8, so that's the newly acceded Edward VI, who was much more of a Protestant, a cross, chalices, censers, an incense boat, and altar vessels were all sold by weight, with more following in 1550, while a chantry with its assets went and altars were removed, all causing local anger. In turn, in 1554 to 1555, as part of the reaction under Mary I, a mass book, a holy water stoop, altar cloths, a new rood, incense and an incense boat were among what was bought. And of course, under Elizabeth I after 1558, it was necessary yet again to change the, as it were, way in which heaven was celebrated and man's destiny in religious terms explained. One can think here about the famous communist adage, of course, about the relationship between history and the present and how these can be changed or not changed. The destruction of the monasteries was a major break with the past, although there could also be a degree of adaptation. It was accomplished by royal commissioners and contributed to the display of royal power throughout the country. So in Carlisle, which was as far distant from London as any town in England, the sub-prior of the Augustinian priory, Sir Richard Howith, was executed in 1538 for allegedly spreading rumours of revolts. And in 1540, the royal commissioners appeared, accompanied by a military escort. Now, Lancelot Salkeld, a clever man, you might say, certainly adept who was the last prior, surrendered the priory and possessions that year, becoming the first dean of the Cathedral Church of St. Mary's, Carlisle, a measure of continuity under royal supervision. And the priory possessions in Carlisle reverted to the dean and chapter. So that was a successful adaptation. And a similar process was followed at Durham Cathedral Priory. Church wealth was used for a range of purposes. In the first major redrawing of diocesan boundaries for centuries, six new sees were created, all urban-based. Bristol, Chester, Gloucester, Oxford, Peterborough, and very briefly Westminster. Moreover, in some cases, monastic churches were purchased by parishes, as in Tewkesbury. And this gave communities an increased ability to control much of their religious life. Though if you've been to Tewkesbury, where there was an abbey, you will know also that there was a considerable amount left in ruin. Rather than for monastic foundations, bequests were now more frequently left for parish churches, educational uses, and almshouses. For example, the Wyndham Select Vestry, founded to manage the property of the dissolved abbey, which was then transferred to the townspeople, took care of maintenance, poor relief, the upkeep of roads and bridges, and other local ends in that Norfolk town. In Norwich, the so-called Great Hospital was refounded in 1547 under the control of the town, providing care for 40 poor inmates, as well as some medical and educational facilities. Indeed, the dissolution of the monasteries helped create opportunities for existing and new corporate bodies and in many towns for the extension of the authority of the town council. This process underlines the potential of what's been called the group personhood, that's not my phrase, that was so important to urban identities. This group identity was a counterpoint to the individualism of townspeople, which could lead to trouble. So in other words, group identity was now much more clearly under the town councils rather than being shared or competed over between church foundations and the town council. Some towns were very hard hit by the loss of wealthy monastic foundations, for example, Abingdon, Bruton, and Glastonbury, but others with a stronger economy, such as Shaftesbury, managed better. Opposition to religious change led to rebellions from 1536, most famously the Pilgrimage of Grace in Yorkshire and the northeast, and these ensured that medieval fortifications not only continued to play a prominent role in the townscape, as in Exeter and Newcastle, but also in conflict. Carlisle was attacked during the Pilgrimage of Grace, but remained loyal to Henry VIII, while York admitted the pilgrims, which is one of the reasons why Henry went up in one of his royal processions there in the beginning of the 1540s. And of course, there's a C.J. Sanson novel set there about Shardlake. And for those of you who are interested, C.J. Sanson also wrote a scholarly article about that royal progress, which appeared in, I think it's Northern History. The resistance of Exeter to siege in 1549 was important to the failure of the Prayer Book Rebellion, and the resistance of London to the failure of Wyatt's Rebellion in 1554. King's Lynn and Norwich were both damaged during Kett's Rebellion in 1549, which was still being annually commemorated in Norwich a century later. In turn, after the reign of Edward VI, which pushed forward the, as it were, devastation of church sites, there was the persecution of the Protestants under Queen Mary, which also provided an urban landscape of commemoration. Daniel Defoe linked the Suffolk clothmaking town of Hadley to both that persecution and the very recent Jacobite Atterbury plot, noting as follows. From Ipswich, this is in his tour through Britain. From Ipswich, I took a turn into the country to Hadley, principally to satisfy my curiosity and see the place where the famous martyr and pattern of charity and religious zeal in Queen Mary's time, Dr. Rowland Taylor, was put to death. In fact, that was in 1555. The inhabitants, who have a wonderful veneration for his memory, show the very place where the stake which he was bound to was set up, and they have put a stone upon it which nobody will remove. But it is a more lasting monument to him that he lives in the hearts of the people. I say more lasting than a tomb of marble would be, for the memory of that good man will certainly never be out of the poor people's minds as long as this island shall retain the Protestant religion among them. How long that may be, as things are going, and if the detestable conspiracy of the papists now on foot should succeed, I will not pretend to say. This urban commemorative landscape has now, to a great extent, been lost. I mean, I noticed, in Exeter, of course, you've got one or two monuments, including one put up in the early 20th century at a time of concern about Catholicism and the Irish question, a monument in that case to Protestant martyrs. But I think it's fair to say now that this, as it were, urban memory has gone. And whereas Fox's Book of Martyrs was in every church in the late 16th century, I don't think you would find it in very many today. And I certainly don't think it would be approved of for its clear-cut view on Catholicism. Thanks in large part to its longevity, the reign of Elizabeth I, who ruled from 1558 to 1603, brought an important degree of stabilisation to a national ecclesiastical settlement. This resulted in a change in urban culture, as Catholic ways of looking at the world faded out or were brought to a close. Earlier in the century, the vitality of mystery plays had been shown, with them, for example, being written down in Wakefield in the 1520s, while the Chester and Coventry plays were reworked in the 1530s. But under Elizabeth, the situation changed. The last recorded performances at York, Coventry and Chester were in 1569, 1571 and 1575, respectively, and attempts to revive performances at York in 1579 and Chester in 1591 were abortive. But as some public rituals were thus brought to a close, they were replaced by others. After 1558, it became commonplace to celebrate the anniversary of Elizabeth's succession date. After 1588, the celebration of the anniversary of the defeat of the Spanish Armada. And after 1605, the celebration of the failure of the gunpowder plot. The Reformation introduced also differentiation between towns in the shape of those that became centres of Protestantism, by contrast, others where Catholicism remained significant. For example, Lewes in Sussex. In the latter case, and more generally, it was often the presence of aristocratic families, the Howards, for example, in Lewes, that helped to, near Lewes, helped to ensure that there was a degree of cover, if you like, for local Catholics, and that was certainly also the case in Lancashire, which was probably the county in the country with the highest percentage of Catholics. The Reformation also led to a measure of standardisation between towns and countryside in the shape of the energy devoted to ensuring the new settlement, the energy devoted by both church and state. Of course, though, regional and local variations in these and other factors were to play a role in the Civil War of 1642 to 46, because despite the efforts of central agencies, there were still significant differences between areas. So, for example, East Anglia was characterised by a Puritanism that was not the case, shall we say, to the same extent, if you like, of a county like Devon. So are also with dialect, both oral accent and words printed, which posed a major difference within towns and also between town and country. Born and educated in Stratford-upon-Avon, but living for long in London, William Shakespeare frequently played with dialect as a humorous device, one often linked to travel distance and the bringing together of strangers, and was able to suggest distance as a result, both physical distance and social distance, and that, of course, was the experience of travellers in Elizabethan England. Now, as a reminder of the variety of urban activities and policy, Exeter Council agreed in 1568 to the construction of three common jakes, as they called it, which were latrines. More seriously, poor diet encouraged diarrhoea, colon parasitic infection, hepatitis and salmonella, while malnutrition stunted growth, hit energy levels, and reduced resistance to ill health, particularly in the 1590s, which was a period of poor harvests and bad weather. Crowded housing conditions, especially the sharing of beds, which was commonplace, and also the effluent from undrained privies running alongside dwellings, helped spread diseases, particularly respiratory infections, in the case of the sharing of beds. And the plague also remained a serious problem, for example, in 1598, hitting hard both Carlisle and Kendal. Most dwellings were neither warm nor dry, and it was very difficult to get clothes dry, which discouraged their washing. Moreover, industrial processes were dangerous to others besides the workers. Dressing and tanning leather polluted water supplies, while urine, usually animal, was widely used for fulling cloth well into the 18th century. The kilns of brick and tile works produced smoke and fumes. More generally, fires were a major risk to urban life. Among the towns suffering major fires were Nantwich in 1583 and Tiverton in 1598, although there'd been no major fire in London since 1212, at least partly due to effective precautions. The Nantwich fire burnt for 20 days, destroyed 150 buildings, and made about 900 people, half the population, homeless. Burning continued for a long time with wooden buildings. Very difficult to put the fire out. We saw that in Exeter when the Royal Clarence Hotel, one of the older buildings in the city, burnt down, and the fire continued smouldering for a very long time and was quite active in its core. Fires challenged town governments and philanthropic practices and resilience. Urban responses to problems drew on medieval precedents, but there were also significant developments. So, in Norwich, a committee set up in 1552 sought to improve sanitation by identifying problems with the waterways, paving streets, using powers of taxation to that end. Elizabeth I ordered a nationwide collection to rebuild Nantwich, contributed £1,000 herself, that was a lot of money, and a local group administered the funds and poor relief and oversaw the purchase of trees for rebuilding the town. In Tiverton, 409 houses were destroyed as a result of a fire caused by the use of straw for cooking rather than more expensive wood. Whatever the size of towns, they shared the inegalitarian and hierarchical nature of the rest of society. The smallest group were the wealthy and prominent, their power expressed in and deriving from their ability to organise others. Legally, they did so as justices of the peace. Generally, they did so economically and also often politically. Their strength extended into the rural hinterland, where they would enjoy influence as a result of their power, and at least partly because they often chose to go and live there, provide a source of credit, purchase and retain estates, and if merchants, control rural industry. Within the towns, this group might be employers and all landowners, and generally enjoyed political power as a result of social status and the oligarchical nature of urban government. The largest urban group were the poor, who tended to lack political weight. Their poverty stemmed from the precarious nature of much employment in even the most prosperous of towns, and from the absence of any effective system of social welfare. Most lacked the skills that would command a decent wage, and many had only seasonal or episodic employment. Day labourers, servants, and paupers were economically vulnerable and often socially isolated. A large number were immigrants from the countryside. As a result of poverty, the poor were very exposed to changes in the price of food and generally lived in inadequate housing. In between these two groups, though not separated rigidly from either of them in economic terms, and many of them coming from above or below, was a third group, the so-called middling sort, who enjoyed a more settled income than the poor. Many in this group were artisans, their economic interests and social cohesion frequently expressed through being members of fraternities of workmen, obviously most famously guilds. In contemporary discourse, they were the poor, but part of the poor were undeserving. In fact, in contemporary discourse, they were the people, but part of the poor were undeserving, a pejorative description that had scant accurate basis. So in other words, the people were the middling sort and regarded as reasonable. Those who were regarded as undeserving were not thus treated. So if you think of Shakespeare's play Julius Caesar, the character Casca refers to the crowd as the rabblement, the common herd, and the tag-rag people. And that very much reflected a top-down view. Alongside relatively static assessments of social structure, as well as the largely fixed spatial distribution of occupations within towns, there were the dynamics at individual, family, and collective levels of change, both in prosperity and independence. So also with the arrival and presence of immigrant groups. For example, Dutch textile merchants in Colchester in the late 16th century had their own church and pastor. There were also so-called foreign churches in London. Indeed, the Reformation led to considerable movement of continental Protestants into England, mostly to towns, while some Catholics left. During the Tudor age, the populations of most towns rose, which was part of the more general pattern of population rise in the 16th century, but there were considerable problems of dearth or shortage and poverty in the 1590s, in part due to poor harvests. There were more serious issues in some towns, for example, Carlisle, where there was not only the plague I mentioned in 1598, but also famine. Shakespeare's native Stratford-upon-Avon, a malting town, was hit by shortages of the barley necessary for malting and by high prices for food, as well as by fires in 1594 and 1595. Tudor London was very much affected not only by immigration, but also by the large-scale migration arising from population growth in England. This migration, with its densification of the urban space and demands on jobs, food supplies and charity, placed pressures on the society and governance of London. In part, the pressures led to a hostile response to immigrants, but there was also a more general tension, as in disputes over the delineation of plots of land, an issue still very frequent today. One response was the use of London viewers, so-called, who were commissioners appointed to resolve boundary disputes. Such problems contributed to the lack of stability, even permanence, in urban living, but the same, of course, was true of its rural counterpart. The unsurprising failure of the Crown to implement an integrated approach to the suburbs ensured that their governance and authority were fragmented, as was that of London as a whole, and this remained the case until the Greater London Council was established in 1965. Moreover, separately, Westminster remained distinct from London. In Westminster, because of opposition by the Crown and the Dean and Chapter to a borough government, a court of burgesses established in 1585 and nominated by the Dean had less power than the city corporation. To contribute to the mélange of clashing power, there was also in Westminster the Middlesex JPs, a high steward appointed by the monarch, the vestrymen of the individual parishes, as well as the local gentry who, one could politely say, were reluctant to heed appropriate authority. This interaction challenged stability, but was also crucial To it. I mean, as it were, everybody significant was a stakeholder. In Westminster, as elsewhere, it was necessary to mediate the enforcement of regulations through a governance in which competing interests had to be negotiated, not only in relations with social supervisors, but also those with those of a similar background or more precarious circumstances. Negotiation involved everything from poor relief, its contributions and entitlement, which was a major issue, to disputes over enclosures or plague regulations. And the same was true of other towns. The area that was most regulated in London was the city, under the mayor and corporation, with its identity celebrated by ritual, church services, for example, or indeed the Lord Mayor's Show. The city was able to call on a network of control in order to enforce regulations, as with the recoinage early in Elizabeth's reign, during which the mayor instructed the livery companies to send representatives into every market in order to ensure that the new coins were accepted, which showed indeed that the city and the government were cooperating. The companies served as ways to regulate, but also to link, which helped to, as it were, contain differences. The latter role of linkage, including between the city and the suburbs. Guild politics indeed proved a way to register as well as contain differences, contributing to a metropolitan community, as compromise was a way to deal with the large-scale disruption brought by economic and religious change. At the same time, concern about the suburbs remained strong and was part of a wider sense of anxiety about change and uncertainty. Poor relief reflected and sought to tackle real pressure in towns, not least because poverty was highly visible in small and crowded settlements where much life was on the street. Towns were thronged with migrants from the countryside, which shed people as the population doubled from the 1520s to the 1650s. And of course, the idea, as discussed in the mid-16th century, that sheep ate people. In other words, that the focus on the cloth product, wool production and the cloth trade meant that there was fewer, less attention to arable. Helped to ensure that there were quite a few deserted villages where the population were pushed out, and a lot of those people went to the towns. Real wages fell appreciably in the towns, further adding pressure on living standards and philanthropy. A series of parliamentary statutes was aimed at discouraging able-bodied beggars while providing relief for what were referred to as the impotent poor. Migrants could find life in the suburbs easier as land and rents were cheaper and regulations less to the fore, although a key aspect was that of the variety of the suburban experience. Much effort and expenditure was required in order to support the social stability and physical fabric of towns, with poverty and vagrancy counterparts in civic attention to the deterioration of the latter. Town councillors were busy. On a long-standing basis, but one accentuated by the tensions arising from religious change and political instability, and then brought to crisis in the 1590s, which was a very troubled decade, also a decade, of course, in which the war with Spain was not going well, urban government sought to address these issues and did so in part by increasing its power and challenging or lessening any democratic tendencies, or at least opposition by those not linked to the governing oligarchy. And this rivalry, in my view, looked towards the political disorder and governmental changes of the following century, although the links were not always clear-cut and sometimes indirect. Let's take a pause there and we'll continue next time. Graham, have you got any particular observations?
Well, I have. Thank you very much indeed, Jeremy. It's such an interesting subject, discussing English towns in the 16th century. You have the extraordinary political consequences and repercussions of the Reformation and also of really quite rapid population growth. I wonder if I may start by asking a question about the consequences of the Reformation with regard to town government. Did this switch from the Catholic order to, and I'm now talking about the Elizabethan settlement, a Protestant one, did that change the way in which towns were governed? Did the role, formal or informal, of church in the local area, did that wax or wane? Or it, actually, in that sense, is the role of the Reformation very secondary to how civic government continued?
Well, that's, I mean, I think what I would say first is that the Reformation is extraordinarily important, obviously, as a religious episode. And, one of the great problems of the discussion of history over the last 80 years, and you can vary the timetable, is that people looked at many religious issues and sought to describe them in really often very crude economical political terms, rise of the bourgeoisie, rise of the nation state, whatever. I mean, particularly heinous examples of that was, I would say, Christopher Hill, who misled a whole generation of impressionable undergraduates. So first of all, there are genuine religious issues at stake, issues particularly of doctrine, but also of organization, of authority, of liturgy, religious culture, religious governance. So those remain important, both between Protestantism and Catholicism and within Protestantism. So Puritanism is different, to, shall we say, what you might regard as High Anglicanism. Now, that is not to say that there were not significant issues for the secular history of the country, whilst reminding ourselves at every point that the secular was less divided from the religious than today. And the ruler, of course, but in some respects, they became closer as the ruler became supreme governor of the church. What I would say in terms of the specifics of town government is that in those towns where there had been authority, significant authority wielded by monasteries, maybe the monasteries had been the principal landowner, or there was a charter giving them significant power, that obviously went up for grabs. And in particular, it was generally the case that that power went to the town council. So, to that extent, there was a significant increase in the independence and power of town councils. I mean, obviously, this is within a context in which you need to differentiate between towns, not least an element I haven't mentioned so far today, but that is between those towns that were parliamentary boroughs. And as you know, parliament becomes more significant, not least as a place where the Reformation is, as it were, affirmed, registered, and legislated upon than had been the case prior to that. Without being Whiggish, I hope I'm not going to be accused of that, there is a degree to which, whatever its imperfections, the arguments by the late Geoffrey Elton about a greater role for Parliament also mean a greater role for those boroughs which most MPs are representing.
Very interesting. I the other thought that occurs to me that the Reformation, as you said, it involved great transfers of wealth, the stripping of the monasteries, but also the redirection of sums of money which would have gone to the Catholic Church in its various forms, but instead found other avenues, whether for philanthropy or for economic ends. I wonder, I mean, you mentioned Lewes as an example of a town which remained very much within a Catholic sphere of influence. Is there much work that's been done on the varying fortunes of towns during the reign of Elizabeth, depending on whether they managed to maintain a Catholic tradition or whether they more full-throatedly embraced the Reformed religion?
I would say in terms of varied fortunes, I mean, I think it's fair to say that it's the First of all, environmental issues, as I've already mentioned, things like, in particular, fire and disease that are crucial. So it didn't really make much difference in Nantwich or Tiverton what the politics or were. They were hit hard by fire, and Carlisle was hit hard by plague. So there's the environmental issues, and there's also the economic issues. And I think it's fair to say that it's generally agreed. I've already mentioned the 1590s was a very hard period of rising food prices, the rising population pressed on a food supply which did not rise to the same extent. There's a kind of Malthusian crisis in the 1590s, and that means towns as a whole suffer. So I think one has to be careful of seeing politics necessarily as the key differentiator between the fate of towns. I would say the key differentiator is environment. I mean, obviously, if you're a town which is heavily associated with a, shall we say, whatever you might mean in this context, conservative society, which I imagine in this context you'd be thinking mostly about a degree of Catholicism, that doesn't necessarily cause a problem after that issue becomes less significant with the failure of the Rebellion of the Earls, Northern Rising, early on in Elizabeth's reign. Most of the 1570s and 1580s are politically quieter from that point of view. And it's instructive that the crisis caused by the arrival of Mary, Queen of Scots, the conspiracies she's linked to, her execution, and the subsequent attempt by Spain to invade, do not see bouts of anti-Catholic pogroms or whatever. I think that's really quite instructive. And one's got to be careful always to read into the past the kind of sectarianism we're seeing at the present moment in places like Leicester, and that we saw in Northern Ireland in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s during the Troubles. And there is an interesting degree to which our people could cooperate or accept people of a different branch of Christianity, I think precisely because under Elizabeth there was a quite clear establishment. And also, each year of Elizabeth's reign, the number of those people that had personally experienced Catholic rule diminishes. And I think that's very important to the consolidation of a new settlement.
Indeed. Well, that's a strong point upon which we'll have to end it for today. But Professor Jeremy Black, talking about the English town in the 16th century during a time of economic, demographic, and religious ferment and change. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.